Okay, we're going to get started. Thank you all for your patience. Thank you for all coming out on this snowy day, and a special thanks to Mark Dybul and his team for coming and being with us today. I'm Steve Morrison. I direct the Africa program here and the HIV/AIDS task force that CSIS has been running now for the past 4 years. This event is part of a very important element of the task force, which is the work of a committee that Jen Cates and Phil Nyberg have been heading up and many of you have been contributing to over the last 2 years, which is one focused on prevention. And we're having this event really as one of the integral elements of that committee. So I'd like to thank both Jen and Phil for leading on this and turn the floor to them to give some very quick opening remarks about why we're here and what we're seeking to do, and then we'll move to Mark for a presentation and then followed by quick Q&A. So thank you all. Any of you sitting along the walls, feel free to fill in on any vacant seats and come to the table. And thank you again for all coming.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jen Cates from the Kaiser Family Foundation. And as Steve mentioned, Kaiser's been working with the task force since its inception, really, on various activities, particularly this committee on prevention. The task force has several committees, and the committees are really a way to get some of the issues and work discussed more in depth and bring that information to the larger deliberations of the task force. And for those who have been involved in the task force writ large, you know that it's a bipartisan effort, and it's really designed to provide dialogue and feedback and information to the U.S. government response on HIV/AIDS globally. And there's been many, many sessions taking on lots of the different issues, even from before the legislation was authorized, that authorized PEPFAR. Prevention is clearly a challenging issue to discuss, and it has been for a very long time, for the history of this epidemic. And when we were thinking about whether or not we wanted to form a committee around prevention, we decided that would be very important because of some of the discussions that have gone on and that we hear about a concern that ultimately it could mean prevention itself was at risk. And we have a one-pager on the purpose of this committee, which you can all pick up out there or download from the site, but it kind of goes into the thinking behind our desire to have a committee. The committee is an open structure, meaning that we invite anyone to be part of discussions. It's really designed to just be a place to have a forum for discussion. And we've put out several reports on prevention issues. A recent one that just came out looks at prevention issues in next wave countries, and that's available now. As part of the work of the committee, what we decided would be helpful is to take on or identify several of the issues that either get talked about a lot or don't get talked about enough, but have questions. And we felt that a discussion around many issues could be helpful to the U.S. government response. So we also have a one-pager on the issues that we are thinking about, and we invite you to suggest some to us, and we will it's really always comes down to a scheduling exercise and trying to get things scheduled. But for example, in June we had a first discussion, well actually last February we had a discussion about the indicators that that PEPFAR is using on prevention. And then last June we had a discussion on substitution therapy for injection drug users and what the U.S. government is doing now that Vietnam is a focus country and what some of the issues are there, not just in Vietnam but in general. And today, obviously, we're talking about the ABC guidance, and Phil will talk a little bit about that and the origin of having that discussion. But you'll see on this one pager that's also out there some of the other topics, and I think you'll see that they're all interesting ones, some of which have been addressed, but I think the unique piece that we want to bring to this is that we will have a discussion about U.S. government role and policy that I think is helpful to everyone, especially us and the folks trying to run the programs. So thank you again for coming. I'll turn it over to Phil, who will talk a little bit about today's session. Then we'll turn it over to Mark, and we'll have plenty of time, I think, for questions.
Thanks, Jen. I'm Phil Nyberg, a senior associate at CSIS, and as Jen mentioned, a co-chair of this Working Committee on Prevention. Jen has given a lot of the background of how we got to where we are today. This particular session came about because of several meetings that CSIS staff had with the staff of the the Office of the Global AIDS Coordinator early last year, and I guess starting at the end of 2004. At one of those meetings, we talked in part about the amount of misinformation that was circulating about various guidelines and rules and regulations. And in part, we felt that some of that misinformation was circulating because of a lack of public information about what those guidelines and rules were. And for example, issues, well, the usual suspect issues, drug use, injection drug use, trafficking guidelines, and particularly the ABC policies. excuse me. Subsequently, one of the things we talked about at that meeting was some examples of misinformation that we had heard. And that, I am a part-time employee of an NGO, and one of the things I heard as an HIV consultant to that organization is that there was a prohibition on condom use in a certain setting. We dug a little further, and it turned out that was a mix of misunderstanding on the part of our staff and misunderstanding on the part of the U.S. government staff in that country team. And we gave subsequently there have been a number of other examples, and so we thought having a public discussion about particularly the condom issue, the ABC issue, would be helpful. And there are certainly issues to be concerned about with U.S. policies at times. I think our collective ability to discuss those issues and to figure out what to do is actually not helped by distortion, or even though it might be inadvertent, of what the rules are. I think that kind of thing, that there's been inadvertent distortion in some quarters at times as well. And that issue, that set of issues, is the spirit behind this session. And as Jen mentioned, one of the roles of the task force and the Working Committee on Prevention is to try and move discussion forward by keeping the issues on the table as clear as possible. So in that spirit, in a moment you'll hear from Dr. Mark Dybul, who is the Deputy Global AIDS Coordinator. And this will be an on-the-record discussion of the U.S. government's ABC guidance policy, or policy guidance. Actually, Mark has been working on issues like this since before OGAC, since before the legislation that Jen alluded to. And it's particularly timely for this session, since many of you are aware that there's been public discussion over the last week or so about yet another controversy with the U.S. government's guidance. And we may hear about that before the end of the session. Mark's going to speak for perhaps 25 minutes, and there'll be Q's and A's at the end. And we will not go around for introductions now, but we'll ask you to introduce yourself as you ask questions. So, Mark.
Thank you very much, Steve. Phil and Jen, and thank you all for coming here. We greatly appreciate the opportunity CSIS has given us to have a dialogue, and we appreciate the relationship with CSIS and continuing dialogues on many issues, this being one of them. We really are open to discussion on many things, including prevention. It's an evolving field. Data change regularly. Experience changes regularly. And we all need to stay on top of it and have discussion. What we'd like to do is have an open, fair dialogue. And that's what we hope to have today and continuing forward, that many people have views. No one has all the right answers, particularly in a difficult area like this. And it's helpful to discuss them and to come up with the best way forward, especially when there's an absence of clear data, which unfortunately we have in many areas of HIV/AIDS. So we greatly appreciate the opportunity, and we thank CSIS for once again, and Jen, also with the Kaiser Foundation, that the opportunity to spend some time with you all and to hear your thoughts. As we talk about the ABC guidance of the U.S. government, we think it's important to talk about how we got to the U.S. guidance. And so if we could just talk a little bit about some data, and I think it's important to look at some recent data because they've just come out and some people aren't familiar with them, particularly in Kenya and a couple of other places that were presented a couple of weeks ago with UNAIDS document. Kenya has seen really a remarkable effect in the last, from 1998, when they've had a reduction in the black line there in the national prevalence from about 10% to 7%, with decreases in urban and rural areas. So it's occurring across the board in about the same pattern, which is remarkably encouraging. This is not an artifact of did they shift from ANC data to more general data, so there wasn't really a change in prevalence. It was just how we measured it. As you can see from these data, there has been a true decline in the ANC data as well, so that going from a peak of around 13% in 2000 down to a peak of around just above 7% in the ANC setting. So the decrease in national prevalence isn't an artifact of shifting from ANC data, which tend to be higher than many areas. In fact, we're seeing the same thing in the ANC data as well. I should point out that these slides come from the permanent secretary of the Minister of Health from Kenya, who came to our office and has asked that we use these slides wherever we want them to. These are their data, and they're putting together of what they're seeing. They've done an interesting mathematical model, and this is one of the most exciting things I've seen in a long time. Based on what they saw in their prevalence and some data we'll run through, they modeled what's happening in terms of new infections, not just prevalence, and the death rate to try to get at why is the prevalence changing. So this is a model. They readily admit that they need to work on it, but this is their current model. So you can see a remarkable thing. One thing is a dramatic decline in new infections and also an increase in the death rate, accounting for that change in prevalence. So it was both things. But remarkably, for those of you who are familiar with public health, what this says is there were more deaths than new infections. That means the infection rate has turned. That means the epidemic has turned. That's the definition of basically a control of an epidemic. So these are really exciting. Again, it's a mathematical model that's being worked out. So why was this change? What happened in the country? And of course, as all of you know with demographic health surveys, you're reading tea leaves. You're looking at results and trying to figure out what happened, but this is how the Kenyans put it together. Kenya has a formal national strategy of ABC, which they've been implementing before PEPFAR. And so they've looked at in their demographic health survey what mattered. And as you can see under the A piece, both among young men and young women, there was a significant decrease in those who have had sexual activity in the age 15 to 24 timeframe. A significant decrease in multiple partners among men, going from 30 to 17%. In condoms, a clear increase in condom use among females age 15 to 49. Not much of a change among the men, but a significant change among the women. So it was from these data, they put together that it was ABC that led to the change in their epidemic. Some backup data in terms of abstinence, the increase of first sexual activity increased by about a year overall, from about 16.1 to 17.1 if you look at the averages. So an increase of about a year in the age of onset of first sexual activity. If you look at abstinence, these are pretty dramatic. You know, there's been a lot about, is secondary abstinence ever possible? These are the first data I'm familiar with that show clearly that secondary abstinence worked. So people who had ever been sexually active, if you look at people who had ever been sexually active in sex in the last year, there's a dramatic decrease. So people who had been sexually active, it appears, became non-sexually active over the last year. So secondary abstinence seems to have contributed to their controlling of the epidemic. And as we mentioned, a significant decrease in people with multiple partners, most pronounced, and this is looking at men, 20 to 24 was the most dramatic, but overall they saw a decrease in the number of partners. They also saw, where's the condom one? They also saw an increase in condom use among young women, and you saw some of those data already. You saw the data already that there was an increase in women of condom use from, I think it was 16 to 24%. So remarkable increase leading them to their conclusions. I think everyone's familiar that it's not easy over a lifetime to do A, B, or C, that these are very difficult things and that you need correct and consistent use of condoms and you need to abstain and be faithful on a very regular basis. These are data that just looked at condom use overall. And of course, you can see to the left that correct and consistent condom use generally decreases infection between 80 to 90%. These are data at 80%, but there are other studies that show 90%. But it has to be correct and consistent use. So if you just look all the way to the left, it's a 79% reduction when you use consistent use. There's a 4.4% infection rate. Irregularly, you use 16.5, but 79% when you don't use condoms at all. So you have to use them consistently. Ward Cates reported these data at the Brazil meeting, looking to see over a 10-year period what happens with condom use. And you could probably do this with abstinence and faithfulness as well. It's just a little more difficult to do. And as you can see, if with male condom use over a 10-year period, if you're doing perfect use, your infection rate's very low. But realistic use means that there's only about a 30% protective effect over a 10-year period. So it basically emphasizes that you need to do A, B, and C on a regular basis, and that's not easy. Behavior change is difficult. One thing we're all focusing on now is that condom use among regular partners is very low, and that as we're moving forward in addressing the epidemic, this may be our most important target. So discordant couples or other couples that are in regular relationships have very low uses of condoms, and so we need to target use in this population, and it's one of the things we're working on. We've been talking about Kenya mostly in the data we've seen from Kenya, which are very dramatic and for which we have a lot of data. UNAIDS also reported that prevalence among pregnant women declined in Zimbabwe from 26% to 21% over a two-year period. Pretty dramatic. And the report attributed to the decline to condom use among casual partners and also reduction in the number of sexual partners. So again, the BC message was very important. And the conclusion from Peter Piot was that in Kenya and Zimbabwe, the declines in HIV rates have been due to changes in behavior, including increased use of condoms, delaying first time they have sexual intercourse, and people having fewer sexual partners. So ABC, again, emphasizing that you need all three components, and this is universally pretty much agreed upon now, and the data are becoming more and more clear. There are data from Ethiopia, Zambia, South Africa, Haiti, Zimbabwe, and Tanzania now that demonstrate ABC behavior change effectiveness, and that's where the data are moving all of us. So where does that's kind of a background of how we've gotten to ABC from a data standpoint or where we are now from currently available data. So let's talk a little bit about how that's fit into the emergency plan. Our overall approach is based on what we just talked about, evidence-based and public health. And the evidence base for ABC, we believe, is substantial and very strong as you can get in behavior, which is, of course, much different than many other parts of science. I think the public health approach is something we want to emphasize a lot because it's also a sense of personal responsibility. The ABC data are very strong, and it's also common sense. The most effective, 100% effective ways to avoid HIV are to abstain from exposures or to be faithful to an HIV-negative partner. It's very important that the fidelity is between HIV-negative people or an HIV-positive and negative person who use protection or use condoms. And that condoms are very effective as well, but not as effective. And they need to be used correctly, consistently. Our fundamental belief is that people deserve that information, that it's our responsibility as public health officials to provide people with the information that will most reduce their risk and to allow them to make choices. Should they choose to engage in riskier activity, they ought to be provided with a condom. But people can't make decisions if they don't have the data, and so we have the responsibility to provide them with the information. In a similar way, we don't just assume people will smoke. We tell them the risk of smoking. And try to encourage them to practice the most safe activity. But if they choose to engage in risky activity, at least they know the risk and made a personal choice. Finally, we believe it's essential that we support national strategies. It is the national strategy and formal national policy in South Africa, Kenya, Uganda, Ethiopia, and multiple other countries to do an ABC approach, and we think we have the responsibility to support those national strategies. The U.S. government didn't begin ABC with PEPFAR. In 2002, USAID issued a guidance which was directed towards ABC based on the data that were available then. And in 2003, Measure Evaluation also did a further analysis. So this ABC data had been building for years, beginning in Uganda, but they're building further, and the U.S. government policies go back to before PEPFAR, but are now fully part of it, continuing the U.S. government strategy. And I thank USAID, the other staff from OGAC, and our other colleagues from the U.S. government who helped put together these slides and have helped create the policy. As everyone knows, ABC needs to be a balanced approach, and it needs to be targeted towards people in their own countries and have messages that are consistent with cultural activities and cultural sensitivity, and that it's different from country to country, but that it needs to be balanced. We issued in January 2005 our formal PEPFAR guidance on ABC, building on the data, the availability of data, and also building on previous guidance. And just to run through that, because some of this is our responsibility. We have not done a great job of communicating, and we need to do a better job. And so we very much welcome and thank all of you for joining us for the opportunity to do this and to listen to people's thoughts on this. It is open. Guidance can change and evolve, so we need to have a constant discussion. The guidance is really structured to define the ABC approach, implementation of the ABC approach, and then some conclusions, and also some guidance on the appropriate mix of ABC interventions, because it is different from country to country and is specific to country to country. In terms of the ABC approach, the guidance mentions that it needs to be a balanced approach, that we can't be heavily weighted in one direction or another, that we need a balanced approach in a generalized epidemic, and it needs to be targeted to the specific needs and circumstances of different populations, and that we need to build human resources necessary to implement all of these. As in treatment and care, we need to build the infrastructure for a balanced ABC approach. It is not a simple approach, so I'm not going to go through all of these. This is the formal guidance, so we wanted to provide it to people, but abstinence isn't one approach. There are many things that need to be done to have effective abstinence programs, many things that need to be done to have effective faithfulness programs. These aren't easy approaches. Behavior change, and I would say that as a physician, behavior change is substantially more difficult than treatment. You have to build an infrastructure for treatment, but we know what to do. It's not, you know, it's pretty basic. We have the science. Behavior change is a remarkably difficult thing that requires a lot more activity, and so these are complicated areas. As you can see, there's not a lot of difference between the complexity of abstinence, faithfulness, or condom use. These are all complicated areas and need complicated strategies and approaches. I think one of the things that's caused most concern is what do we do in terms of abstinence? And one of the phrases I would like to get off the table is abstinence only. Abstinence only is for kids. It's for young children who should receive nothing more than abstinence only education. Once you get past that age, messages are more nuanced, and ABC is what you need to talk about. But again, within the confines of cultural sensitivity and age important. So one of the things I think people need to stop doing is saying that our congressional directives and our approach is abstinence only. It is not. It's ABC, with abstinence only directed at the appropriate age, where that is all they should get. And to be honest, if people can disagree here, I have rarely come across someone who believes you should do anything more than abstinence education for a 10-year-old. And it's kind of interesting to talk to people who have a policy position, then you ask them what they would do with their own daughter or their own son, and they'd say, well, of course I'd just tell them to abstain. So it's a common sense approach, and I think 90% of people would agree on that. Once you get past 14, the guidance directs an ABC message that is appropriate as people enter a different phase of their life, with heavy emphasis on AB, but knowledge about C as well. In school, and another difference we have is in school and out of school. In schools, we can provide education on ABC, but we will not provide condoms in schools. If people engage in risky activity or decide to engage in risky activity, they are to be referred out of the schools. So above 14, we support education about condoms, but not the distribution of condoms. Outside of schools for youth, we do support the distribution of condoms. So it's a complicated, nuanced approach, and I encourage you to read the guidance to look at it to see what we actually do support and don't support. There are priority interventions for behavior change as well, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this either. I just wanted to, again, emphasize that there are important issues around even education for youth, that you don't just target youth in schools, that you have to get to the parents, get to the thought leaders in the community, that this is another approach to get at children and youth behavior and behavior change, that you don't just emphasize school or out-of-school programs, that you need to get into the homes and into the thought leaders in the community as well. And this just emphasizes that again. But I want to emphasize something here, because this is another area that there seems to be confusion and we need to do a better job of describing. We talk about two aspects of condom promotion and behavior change: high-risk activity and high-risk groups. It's important to remember that what we're dealing with in general in Africa are generalized epidemics, not concentrated epidemics. And in generalized epidemics, you're talking about activity in a generalized population. You know, parts of Botswana where 75% of pregnant women are infected, whole countries where adult populations, 30 to 40% are infected. These are generalized epidemics. So it's high-risk activity within a generalized epidemic, and then there are high-risk groups. In concentrated epidemics, of course, high-risk groups are identifiable. And you can target them much more easily and effectively. In a generalized epidemic, you have high-risk activity, and then you have a subset of high-risk populations. So we talk about both, the need to address both in a generalized epidemic. So we talk about high-risk activity, and this gets to educating people about what their risks are, abstinence and faithfulness to an HIV-negative person being the most 100% effective way to avoid infection. But if you're going to engage in risky activity in the setting of a generalized epidemic, condoms need to be available for anyone who engages in high-risk activity, including young adults and others. But also, even within generalized epidemics, you still have concentrated epidemics among prostitutes and their clients, among substance abusers. I actually have never approved of having men who have sex with men as a high-risk group. It's like heterosexuals who engage in high-risk activity are not. And we know from Thailand, Cambodia, the Dominican Republic, and other places that if you target high-risk populations, you can have an effective approach. But it's not enough in a generalized epidemic to just concentrate on those populations. You have to deal with people who have high-risk activity as well. And I think there's been a lot of confusion about what our policy and practice is here. And our policy and practice is you still target high-risk populations, but you also address everyone who engages in high-risk activity in a generalized epidemic. If there's a better way to describe this and to communicate this, please help us with it. It's a complicated area, we know, and we're trying to describe things as best we can. So that's our policy. That's our actual policy. That's actually what we guide people to do. Full ABC, with A really being directed to young kids. As you advance older, it's A, B, and ABC, with a difference in school and out of school and targeting parents and looking at high-risk activity and high-risk groups. How does that break down to what we actually do? If we look here at budget allocations, I think it's important to note something we sent up to Congress in June of 2004. As many of you know, and we'll talk about in a second, there's a congressional directive for 33% of all prevention for abstinence until marriage programs. We have formally defined for Congress that abstinence until marriage means basically A and B. And the reason for that is that except for young children, you would never segregate an A message from a B message, that you have to give them together once you get out of young kids. And so we have formally defined abstinence until marriage as abstinence and fidelity, abstinence and partner reduction, abstinence and faithfulness until marriage, that's all part of the same message. So that 33% really is covering A, B. And that was sent up to Congress in June of 2004. As Phil mentioned, and as I just mentioned, there is a congressional directive that in this year, 2006 being a full directive, not try to get there, but in this year, 2006, you will achieve 33%, not less than 33% of the amounts appropriated pursuant to the Act shall be expended for abstinence until marriage programs. I've just defined for you what abstinence until marriage is, but this is a formal directive that must be met this year. in order to help countries or guide countries to achieve the congressional directive, we issued additional guidance last in August as guidance as how you could get to the congressional directive. And here it's important to note, which we'll talk about in a moment, that prevention is not just sexual transmission. Prevention is prevention of mother-to-child transmission. It's safe blood. It's safe medical injections. And so that accounts for some of our budget as well. And in fact, as we'll see in a moment, about half of our budget expenditures are in prevention of mother-to-child transmission and safe blood and safe medical injections. The reason for that is that it's those are much more expensive activities. It's not because 50% of the infections occur in those activities. It's because those are much more expensive interventions than sexual transmission. So if 50% of your budget is for non-sexual transmission, within the 50% that is sexual transmission, 66% devoted to abstinence until marriage, or AB, gets you to 33% of overall. So 66% of 50% is the same as 33% of 100%. Nothing has changed. It's the same percent. It's just guidance on how to achieve the congressional objectives. I would point out that we were very clear with people, and the guidance itself states very, very specifically that if this percent is not appropriate for your country, tell us why and submit an operations plan that doesn't utilize it, using the specific example of Vietnam, where we would not expect Vietnam to follow this type of guidance or a concentrated epidemic to follow this type of guidance. If you look at the budget from 2004, or 2005 rather, you'll see this breakdown. So about 46% went for treatment, about 26% for care, and then within prevention, which was 28% of total prevention, 7% went for AB activities, 7% went for condoms and related prevention activities, 3% for injection safety, 5% for blood safety, and 6% for mother-to-child transmission. So it basically shows that 50% went for these medical interventions and 50% for sexual transmission. And within that, last year, we were at about 56% AB and 44% condom promotion and related activities. We need to get to 66% to meet the directive and also to have some good programs. I just wanted to point out something else that I've seen, and we just want to make it abundantly clear. There are actually comments that we are reducing the number of condoms that we provide around the world. Absolutely untrue. But what we want is a balanced approach. The condoms we provide are now within the context of ABC. They are not condom-only programs. They are ABC programs. So we have significantly increased our AB program, and we've also increased our C program to have that balance we've talked about. So from 2001, the last budget of the previous administration, the U.S. government provided around 350 million condoms to the world. In 2005, we provide around 570 million condoms to the world. Clearly not an aversion to condoms, an aversion to condoms that aren't prevented in an ABC context. If one looks in the focus countries, in 2001, the U.S. government provided around 115 million condoms. In 2005, 241 million condoms, more than double. And if you look country by country, every country stayed approximately the same or went up significantly. The one exception is South Africa, where in 2001 there were 21 million condoms, and in 2005 there were zero. Well, what happened there? Well, in the year 2000, it was 0.2. In 2001, the government needed a short-term stopgap measure, so we supported some condom purchase. In South Africa, the South African government pays for all the condoms. So in virtually all years, our number is zero because the South African government covers it itself. So this is not an opposed to condoms program. This is a condoms within a fully ABC program to combat HIV/AIDS on the continent of Africa, consistent with the national strategies in those countries, which emphasize A, B, and C, because you have to have the AB component and you have to emphasize the AB component as well as condoms if people choose to engage in risky activity, or you're not going to combat the epidemic. I want to touch briefly on some large-scale issues which we talk about as well. ABC is by far the most effective approach to tackle HIV/AIDS in a generalized epidemic, particularly in Africa, and the data are clear. But there are circumstances where ABC is difficult. In gender issues, it's difficult for a woman to negotiate A, B, or C. And so we need to deal with gender as a broad-scale issue if we're going to tackle HIV effectively. There are many data which many of you are familiar with that some of the highest risk groups are young girls. And that the issue of cross-generational sex, or older men having sex with young girls, is a fundamental driver of the epidemic in certain areas. And so we need to address these issues if we're going to fully combat HIV, if we're going to allow ABC to work fully. It works extremely well, but to have it have the greatest impact, we need to address gender issues. Coercive sex, as many of you know, is a significant risk factor in many places. So gender is a priority for us if we're going to tackle HIV/AIDS and prevent HIV/AIDS. So we've established a technical, I don't want to start this way. I hate it when government says, well, the way we're dealing with an issue is by developing a working group and having meetings. But we are, in fact, developing a working group and having meetings as a starting point. But that's a starting point. What we're doing now is gender consultation, which will occur early in this year, which will help us design programs so that we can, in 2006 and 2007, we've set money aside for this, implement programs based on that consultation that will address gender and evaluate the most effective programs so that we can spread them out. So there will be a significant push in 2006 to do programmatic interventions that we can then evaluate. There's a significant focus in the 2000 COPs on men and B, which we think is very important to address gender issues, fidelity issues, and men so that they don't do bad behavior, and continuing our support for microbicide research, availability of female condoms, sharing of best practices, and significant rape prevention and PEP programs. We have some great programs focused on gender-based violence in Zambia and Kenya, working with men to change norms in South Africa, trying to decrease cross-generational sex in Uganda, and women's access to services. Women's access to services is critical, and as many of you know, 56% of the people who received antiretroviral therapy in 2004 were women. Alcohol and HIV is a significant issue, and we're beginning to address it. And this is one of those cross-cutting things we need to deal with. We had an interagency meeting in August of 2005 that's leading to best practices and evidence base that will lead to more alcohol programs. So that's all I want to talk about. I just want to conclude with something that President Bush said on World AIDS Day. We're working with our partners to expand prevention, emphasize abstinence, being faithful in marriage, and using condoms correctly. This strategy, pioneered by Africans, has proven its effectiveness, and America stands behind the ABC approach to prevention. We continue to stand by it. We are trying to enforce it, and we look forward to working with you to see how we can best do it and to address information as it becomes available. So with that, I'd like to open it up for conversation.
Okay, what we'd like to do is take about three questions, and please let us know who you are and state your question, and then we'll let Mark respond, and others from your staff, Mark, if they could answer as well. So, any questions? Janet?
Do I need this? I'm not sure. Thank you, Mark, very much for taking the time to be here and to discuss these issues. And I think you have touched on some of the areas where there has been a lot of controversy. And I know, and I think many others who have been in the PEPFAR countries have been aware of a lot of concern on the ground about ABC, both from the U.S. government actors and partners, as well as from the NGOs on the ground, who have a broader sense that the C part is really supposed to be reserved for very at-risk populations. And therefore, anybody involved in C is sort of facing additional stigma, because if you actually need condoms, you're really a high-risk kind of character. And unfortunately, that's the way it has filtered down in a lot of the programs, to the point that I myself have been at programs where literally targeting sex workers and truck drivers, where I was told that they have condoms as a last resort, even for these most at high-risk populations, because they're frankly so afraid to talk about condoms to international visitors. And I think that also you pointed out some of the contradictions in that if more than half of those living with AIDS in sub-Saharan Africa are women, and if, as you described, ABC doesn't, they can't really control A, B, or C, are women in general then a high-risk population for whom this strategy is only partially effective? And then what does that mean in terms of a kind of addendum to the guidance about how will OGAC more broadly address the risks and vulnerabilities that women and girls face? So I wonder if you could address a little bit of sort of the gaps in the guidance that you sort of talked about later, but in fact aren't included in what the guidance itself says, and the perception problem, if that's all that it is, but I think it may be a little bit deeper than that, the concerns that partners have on the ground that, in fact, there's such a reluctance to talk about C that they want to steer well clear of it.
That was actually a great question.
Sorry.
But they are very important questions, and I'm glad you raised them. First, I think the facts are important. We hear that people are concerned about condoms, but you know, the fact that we're supplying more than twice as many in the focus countries over a short period of time should be pretty good indication that people are comfortable using them. I do think there is some perception problem. And to be honest, some of that perception problem comes from a lot of the misinformation that gets characterized. I mean, when people are constantly reading stories, or people are flying from the US Europe to a country in Africa to say that the US is opposed to condoms, that kind of stuff has an impact on people. And to be honest, guidance, people don't read guidance every day, but they see what's in the papers all the time. And that's why I think what Phil pointed out is critical, that we keep the conversation. There's room for conversation here. There needs to be a dialogue. There needs to be a conversation. But we need to keep away from the misinformation, because this misinformation has an impact on people in the field. They actually think that that's the policy because that's what they read in the paper. And it's not just U.S. government folks. It winds up being our partners. Our partners don't read the guidance, really. So this misinformation directly contributes to problems on the ground, and that's why we're so worried about it. We've got to get away from tossing arrows at each other and sitting down and having a conversation. So I do think there could be a perception problem, but clearly at least the condom numbers are going up, but so is the AB program. I want to be very clear, though, that we do want to shift what we've done. AID began this process in 2003 and 2002 and 2003, but we are shifting what we've done. Condoms only aren't going to work in Uganda or Africa. They'll work in Vietnam or Cambodia in a concentrated population, but they're not going to, that you can't, we had many years of adopting a strategy that worked in Cambodia and Thailand to Africa. It's not going to work. We want to change. We also want people to follow the guidance and fully the guidance, but we want ABC. We want all of that. And so there is a shift, and there will be some discomfort, and that's necessary because we do need to get to full ABC, but we also want people to follow the guidance. We need some help getting out there. You know, it is high-risk activity in a generalized epidemic as well as targeted populations. So we want people to be doing both. And there are certainly many programs. I mean, TASO in Uganda doesn't deal with high-risk populations, and they distribute condoms very widely, but they do it in the context of ABC. And they target kids, and they look at adults, and they give a full message. So some of our partners know we need to make sure everyone understands that in a generalized epidemic, there are high-risk activity, and everyone needs the ABC approach. And then there's high-risk groups where you do more targeted activity. And anything anyone can do to help us, give us advice on how to get the message out better, please, we're open to it. The issue of women is, of course, a major issue. But this was guidance for ABC. So that's why we're doing these consultations, to deal with cross-cutting issues, because gender issues aren't just about ABC. Gender issues cover everything in HIV, counseling and testing, treatment, everything. Clearly, some women can negotiate condoms, and some women can insist on fidelity and abstinence, because that's what we're seeing, for example, in Kenya and Uganda, that there is an impact here. But it needs to be greater, and we need to get at these pockets of problems, where you do more than pockets, where you do have gender issues. So the ABC guidance was to address ABC itself and what we should do in ABC. Gender is a broader issue, and that's why we're trying to deal with it in a broader context, and that's what the consultation will do. But it's a critical issue, and we need to address it. But that's why it wasn't addressed in this guidance.
Hi, Judy Auerbach from AMFAR. Mark, I'd like to pick up on the sort of perception and communication theme, because I think this is the issue with which we are all contending. And I think had what we call ABC, the construct, been articulated as in its epidemiological, it's sort of more true and less catchy epidemiological version, which is delaying the onset of intercourse among young people by a year. That would be the A. You know, reducing numbers of sex partners. That would be the B. And condom use correctly and consistently would be the C. What's happened is that the construct emerged, however it emerged, and the articulation of it has become problematic. So some of us who do read the guidance very carefully, because we want to know exactly how things are defined and how things are operationalized and how things are communicated to the implementers and fundees, see in that articulation the problem. So, for example, the language, it's the specific way in which the A, the B, and the C are operationalized and defined and articulated in these documents that I suspect leads to some of the perception issues that then lead to the communication issues. So when I see, for example, language, as I do in this guidance and some other government documents, that says faithfulness in marriage, you know, no abstinence until married. Well, for me, that discounts all homosexual people around the world. If I see you know, that partner reduction is an absolute zero to a faithful relationship in a heterosexual couple, that eliminates a lot of possibilities for real people. And furthermore, there's actually a lot of language in talking about reducing risk, whether it's the A and the B or even the C language, that suggests that anybody who's HIV infected is an inappropriate marriage mate or partner, because there's always specific language to, you know, you're best off if you have sex in a faithful relationship with an uninfected partner. Well, in a high prevalence area, you've pretty much ruled out a whole lot of people as appropriate marriage mates. So I could go on in my sort of textual analysis, but the point is that I think that's exactly why people have these very uncomfortable responses to what, in theory, could be a very legitimate epidemiologic approach to mitigating transmission and acquisition. So I'm wondering, to put this into a question rather than a statement, what are the possibilities of talking about some of that with some select group of people, perhaps, but really revisiting the language that actually does appear in the guidance and in other documents to address some of these issues that I think legitimately raise perception issues that then gets translated down the line and cause you a lot of heartburn? So can that language be revisited? I mean,
Also along the lines of, I'm Heather Boonster with the Guttmacher Institute. So also along the lines of just perceptions is, you know, not just conversations here in D.C., but what are you doing in order to get the message to, you know, possible organizations that you might fund, and what kind of programs might be acceptable? Because I think in looking at the epidemiological evidence, that a lot of groups assume that in order to achieve A, that you have to have an A program, and to achieve B, you have to have a B program. But in fact, more comprehensive programs can actually achieve A as well, and it's really those outcomes that we're interested in. And so what are you doing to change perceptions within the field and to make the guidance clear to potential funders that, in fact, you know, as the guidance says, that older teens are appropriate audiences for more comprehensive messages. So that's question number one. And then also in terms of making things clear, as you said, that women's access to services is also very critical. And we know that an entry point to getting to women is family planning clinics. And so along the lines of family planning clinics applying for PEPFAR funding, there has been some confusion in the field about whether they are eligible for that funding, if they have in fact signed the Mexico City policy, and what OGAC is doing to clarify the Mexico City policy as it pertains to family planning funds as opposed to HIV/AIDS funds.
Jen, I think you make a great point, but kind of like PEPFAR, where people are saying, let's revisit the name, the name PEPFAR, ABC's with us, and I mean, it would take forever to change it. Plus, I think it does capture something that's important. But I think what's critical is what defines it under it, which is why I think if you look at what's under it, what does abstinence mean? What does fidelity mean? We're so careful about trying to outline what these things mean. From a scientific perspective, I do worry a little bit about saying abstinence really means age and first onset of activity. That's the epidemiological outcome. That was not the epidemiological message. The message that the kids got was abstain. It wasn't delay onset for a half a year. Now, if you gave a kid a message of delay your onset for a half a year or a year, what might they actually do with that message? Might we actually get a delay of a day or two? The message that they got, in other words, it's difficult to correlate the outcome, the epidemiological outcome, and say, well, that's the message that should be given. We need to look at what the message should be given and what leads to the epidemiological outcome. It's difficult. We don't know. And this is one of the complicated things. We don't know. Behavioral work, as you know, is much more complicated. But I think it's worth looking at how to best describe these things, and I think it's important to do that. I think it's also important to note one of the most important things about the guidance is cultural sensitivity. So what the message given in country is much different than what we would say here to our own kids. You know, 30% of people in Botswana are married. Absence until marriage doesn't mean a lot in Botswana. Faithfulness in most countries in Africa means go to church. People don't actually use the term faithfulness because that's what it means. They use things that are culturally appropriate, like zero grazing. So all of these things are applied in a culturally sensitive way. But there's always room for improvement, no doubt about it. But I think ABC is a good phrase. We need to define what it is. Just like everything else, we need to define what it is. Without definitions, the things don't mean very much. So I think they're both very good points. And we're open to discussions and conversations and advice on how to deal with some of this stuff. And Mike Castle's here, who thinks about this stuff for a living. So he's always available for a consultation. Caroline Ryan thinks about this all the time, too. So if you have specific ideas on how we can try to describe this stuff better to be clearer in the field, we're very, very open to that. It's very difficult, but we're very open to talking about it. But that ABC piece, I think, needs to stay there with the cultural sensitivity. There's room for conversation around that, too. But I think we're going to be pretty strong on that. In terms of the question that was asked about what we're doing with organizations we deal with to get some of the messages across, and that there are different types of programs. On the ground, that's really done pretty regular. I mean, the purpose of guidance is not to be specific. The purpose of central guidance is to give the general guidance, the general message, and then it's really our people on the ground, which is why we do bilateral programs, because we have epidemiologists and AIDS experts and prevention people, U.S. government officials on the ground working in country to help work with the partners. So centrally, we actually do very little of that. We want them on the ground working with their partners so that they can develop culturally appropriate messages that fit the ABC guidance, but we don't want to be overly restrictive here. But there are ways we can do things that would make it clearer. But again, you know, AB programs, that's why we defined to Congress that abstinence until marriage is really AB, because except in young kids, you would never segregate an A message from a B message. It doesn't make any sense to tell a 20-year-old or 22-year-old A, not B, because the hope is that they it's quite likely that they will be in a relationship, and so that they need to have that B message at the same time as well, that you wouldn't do a program that separates them. Similarly, you wouldn't do a C program with most people, in our view, without the A and B, because people deserve the options for their choice, and that's what our programs are. Now, we have to report to Congress what dollars were spent, so we desegregate them when we do the dollar amounts, but they're more complicated programs than that. And again, I think the reality on the ground is much different than what we see here. And a great example of that is, I don't know if you saw David Brooks' column after we took him to Mozambique. We were in rural Mozambique. I mean, way up country, impossible to get to, particularly when it's raining. We were up in the hills. We met in a small church half the size of these tables that was all thatch with 13 evangelical conservative pastors. And we asked them, what do you tell your congregation about prevention? what they said is, we tell them to use condoms, but in the context of a larger message of abstaining and faithfulness, and then if you're going to engage in activity, by all means, use a condom. That's basically ABC. That's what people do on the ground, no matter who they are. And so a lot of things we talk about in terms of desegregation and dollars and guidance, that's not what happens on the ground. But we do need to be as clear as we can in the guidance. So we're very open to, you know, the things Judy raised about how do we do a better job at explaining what these things mean, how do we make sure that people are doing full programs. And if we do that, and again, there's room for disagreement and comments and trying to figure this out, but if we all do that in the context of not misrepresenting what each of us are saying, we'll have a much better shot at it. Oh, Mexico City. Again, we give very clear guidance on this. There's very clear guidance on family planning clinics. It's a great entry point, particularly for counseling and testing, that ideally we would be doing counseling and testing in every family planning clinic in the focus countries, and we'd be referring them to appropriate programs. As everyone knows, the president issued an executive order exempting HIV/AIDS programs from Mexico City. We have made that known very widely in the field. When we had our meeting with everyone in the U.S. government from the focus countries, that was explained to them. But I want to be very clear, not a dollar of U.S. government money will go for abortions. But people who are engaged in activities that we will not under any circumstances support with any dollar amount, but can advance HIV/AIDS with resources that are completely separated from those activities we will not support, then that is allowable. And the reason for that was basically the compassionate response of an emergency response, get as many people as possible responding who can respond, but not a penny of U.S. government money going for activities that we don't support.
Other questions? Alan?
Alan Moore with Global Health Council and CSIS. Mark, we looked at the numbers here, and there's been some controversy over the way this 2/3 of 50% was described. When one understands that the law requires 33%, you've got to get there somewhere, somehow, or get close to that. And I think... probably your creative definition of abstinence until marriage that includes A and B is probably a surprise to some, but hope everybody recognizes how significant that was. Having said that, what's happening in the field now that you've got this 66% of 50%? Is it working, or is it creating problems? Because the number on its face, even with the expanded definition, raises questions. You know, how does that requirement, required by law, translate into you being able to do what you want to do?
It's an excellent question. As in all things, it's difficult. Everything you do is a challenge. You know, implementing new programs is a challenge. And there are certainly people who don't like ABC overall, and we're dealing with that constantly too. But I think it's pretty variable. I think one of the important reasons everyone should recognize that we tried to issue this guidance was we don't want to PMTCT programs to suffer, for example, if you're going to expand to meet congressional directives. That's not the intent here. We don't want to cut back on PMTCT programs, that you need to do safe, blend safe medical injection programs, but we also need to meet the congressional directive. So, you know, this is the first time we've done it. We're spending a lot of time with different countries. Some countries really didn't believe, I think because of a lot of the misinformation that they heard, that we were serious about justify if you don't think this is the right thing to do. For example, Guyana is basically a concentrated epidemic. Guyana's COP came back at meeting the directive, which didn't make sense to us, so we're now going back to them saying, we need to rethink this. This is not necessarily the right thing to do. So there is a lot of back and forth on this. But I also want to be very clear that we need a balanced program. that we need a full ABC program. We will encourage, we will do more than encourage, we will enforce a full ABC program. But it's going to take a lot of time back and forth to make sure that we have the right mix of programs. With or without congressional directives, it takes a lot of work to make sure that we have balanced programs. And of course, we don't know what all the countries together are going to add up to until we see each individual COP and add them together. So we have to do a little bit of massaging and moving around too. So it's not easy. But I don't know that it's because necessarily of guidance or directives. It's just difficult within any budget to balance, to have a balanced program. And so we spend time on that. But it's not easy. It's not easy. And there's constant back and forth.
Other questions? Yeah.
Yeah, hi. My name is Ian Tweedy with Johns Hopkins Center for Communication Programs. And you ended your presentation by asking how can we best do the ABC approach. So I didn't want to really focus on the ABC per se, but that last question on how best to implement it. Because our job is working with organizations and countries to come up with these messages and get them out as best as possible. And I think that I know you've had the opportunity to visit some of our community-based programs in Namibia. And we really see community-based as a very important component of behavior change programs. But we also think that there's a very important element to mass media in terms of scaling up the program. And there's lots of creative opportunities to use mass media to support and strengthen community-based approaches. So I was wondering what your position is on mass media, because we've been told in this latest round of the COP proposals to de-emphasize the use of mass media.
It's a very good question. I just went back here because you see in the last bullet, mass media is specifically mentioned. Mass media can be very effective. But again, it gets to balance. Traditionally, the U.S. government has spent a very significant amount on mass media, perhaps some of the most, by far the largest thing we were doing. And to be honest, it needed to be done then. I mean, there, as you well know, there's a... you have to get to a point of knowledge base. And the only way to do that in a lot of ways is mass media. You have to be aware of HIV and the ways to avoid HIV. And you need mass media for that. And you need mass media to reinforce that continually. But once you get the awareness, you not only need to have mass media to maintain that awareness, you need to do the hand-to-hand combat, door-to-door approach to actually change behavior. There are reams of data, but you don't need it to know that awareness doesn't lead to behavior change, which is why people still smoke, even though it can kill them, and people don't eat well, including myself, all the time, and drink, and all these things that we know are bad for us, we do them anyway. And so that's where the behavior change piece comes in. So it's not anti-mass media. It's a balance, again, that there be mass media for the awareness and maintenance of awareness, but that we do the programs on the community, local level that will then change the behavior as well. I think one of the best examples of this that I can think of is the Minister of Health in Mozambique told me that in every single village in Mozambique, there's a single thought leader. It can be a completely different person from community to community. It can be the traditional healer in one, the local priest in another, an auntie, which is a woman people go to before they enter adolescence, in another. And that you can do whatever you want, but unless you have those people on board to give behavior change messages, you're not going to do anything. So you can put up all the posters and education you want. People are completely aware of what they should be doing, but they're not going to change. And so it was more balanced that you need to do both things. And that community-based, faith-based organizations that are on the ground, as well as international other organizations on the ground pushing these messages at the local level, are essential too. So it wasn't anti-mass media. It's anti any one approach, that there needs to be a balance.
I had just a couple of comments to put out and maybe hear from you, Mark. The data you put up about recent successes and quantifying recent successes in the focus countries, you put up one, particularly the Kenyan data, but then you said there are five or six other countries where there's similarly convincing quantifiable data. I mean, I was struck by that. I mean, it's still early days. And if that data is coming out and it's as compelling as the Kenyan data and the other data are all of that same quality, that gives you a lot more, that gives you a powerful ability to change the conversation. And it flies against the general perception that we've seen documented over and over again, which is accurate, which is in the big macro picture, the prevention game is not winning, that the pandemic is continuing to expand. Yet in these pockets of focused, concentrated areas, you're seeing a reversal. And you need to make, you know, I would suggest you need to make a much more strategic use of that data as it's coming forward, because it's quite heartening and compelling. Second is that, you know, we've gotten ourselves into a box here, it seems to me. And it all goes back to kind of the legislative approach and creating these categories and these rigidities and pitting different communities against one another in a competition for resources and prioritization and the like. You have odd and unforeseen bedfellows in this whole coalition, in the sense of you've got religious conservative communities, you've got secular public health folks, you've got old line development and health promotion folks in a mix now where there's a lot of enduring tensions there, and they're not going to go away. And in the broader picture, within our country, a much more polarized political environment. So hearing you say we need more dialogue, we need more communication, I think is extremely helpful and healthy thing to say. I think saying there needs to be more accountability and discipline in the way people talk about these issues, also very important. My question is, where do you find the big voice in this administration or in Congress or somewhere else? Where do you find the stature or the big voice that can command respect across these different constituencies to change the discourse around prevention and what is involved and how we need to see all the different elements and be mature and pragmatic? Because otherwise, if this trend of a continued escalation and polarization continues, it's going to eat away the bipartisan compact that got us here in the first place. It's going to feed an image that this is a nasty area to work in that promotes these kind of bitter battles rather than results in a terribly important part of the world. And what is missing today is someone of enormous stature stepping forward and saying, "Wait, we need to revisit this issue with a different kind of discourse." Thanks.
Both excellent points. On the first one, you know, we've known about Uganda. People didn't want to believe Uganda. Now we've got Kenya, Zimbabwe. The Caribbean has a great success. And we're just getting the data, just as it took a while for Cambodia and Thailand and the concentrated epidemic successes. And I do want to be very clear that when I mention those countries as a whole have increasing epidemics, but they have pockets and provinces or other areas that have fully implemented ABC where we're seeing differences. So it's pockets of those other countries as opposed to the overall country. But there is great hope. And I think Peter Piot tried to deliver this message around World AIDS Day when they issued their report, and it didn't quite get picked up well enough that there is actual hope, even though there were more infections in the Caribbean, in these countries in Africa, even in a pocket of India, and in Tamil Nadu, we're seeing some success. So I absolutely agree that we need to do more on that, and it's going to be important that everyone rally around that. You know, we can cry out all we want, but we're going to need everyone in this room and others to be looking at the successes and talking about them, and we need to do our job as well. In terms of the big unifier, I mean, I don't know what to say to that. And you've heard me say before, if we could all get ourselves to actually talk to each other more and leave mistrust. I think mistrust is a big issue, and we just need to get to trust each other. I think 90% of people agree on everything we would say. 90% of people would agree with the guidance we have. Changes need to be made, need to be communicated better, but most people would agree with the basic tenor of the ABC guidance. Most people would agree on virtually everything we talk about. The problem is you get 5% on either side bringing down the 90% that agree. And it really is discipline among the 90% to say, look, we trust each other. We've got differences. We'll work them out, but we're going to stick together. I don't know how much more clear the president could be on his views. I mean, it's kind of comical to me to look in Europe where heads of state will never use the term condom, ever. Yet you have the president of the United States saying ABC over and over and over again, based on data, based on the fact that it's effective, based on the fact that it's the only way we're going to tackle this epidemic. Where else to look, I don't know. I don't know we'll ever find a one person. I think it's incumbent upon all of us in this room and that 90% to just hold our ground and say you're not going to destroy that. You're not going to do to AIDS what has happened to so many other things. It's just too important. Too many people will die. So let's hold our ground. When people start flinging things around rather than immediately listening to them, let's actually pick up the phone and talk to each other. Let's do more of these things where we can all come together. Let's talk about it. And I'm not naive enough to think we're going to agree on every single topic. We shouldn't. If we all agreed on every single topic, this is too complicated a disease with too many different things. But we can at least trust each other. And if we can get to that, that's what we need to get to. Maybe we need one person or a group of people to push it. But if it's not the 90% holding ground, we're not going to succeed.
Okay, over here. And then.
Carrie Hessler-Radlett from JSI. Thank you very much for coming here. And I agree that one of the problems is that there hasn't been very active dialogue. So what can we all do? What can OGAC do to show leadership in the area of opening up communication, conversation with the groups around the table that are, in fact, doing the work in the field? How can we more actively engage with you? And how can you maybe provide more information to us so that we understand better and can become your advocates instead of opponents?
Be able, I think, to take two more questions. So Judy, and was there anybody else who had a question? Okay.
Thanks. You're a scientist, Mark. I'm a scientist of a different ilk, but still scientist. And we're both data-driven, and you've used the word a couple times, which I very much appreciate. One of the dilemmas I think many of us have had in getting to some clear answer about what happened in Uganda, you talked about people don't want to believe what happened, is in being able to attribute outcomes to particular interventions, for lack of a better word. So it's a very interesting discussion Jen and I, others have been engaged in about the sort of biomedical paradigm that rules and that requires certain outcome measures to be taken as the only evidence of efficacy, like infection rates you can attribute to a specific intervention. Well, you're seeming to accept that basic epidemiologic outcomes attributed to a basic approach is good enough to make claims about something being effective. On what basis are these current data, like the Kenya data, and you mentioned the Caribbean, wherever else, where you're seeing declining infection rates, on what basis can you attribute those outcomes to what you're assuming is the ABC approach you've told us is? What exactly went on? Can we say these specific interventions occurred and these outcomes derived from those interventions? Or are you saying, well, we know this overall approach occurred with a bunch of different programs, and then we saw these outcomes, so let's just all agree they were effective without having to make that very particular linkage between an intervention in some controlled way and an outcome?
Both very good questions. In terms of the first one, I know you didn't mean the last sentence of being opponents. I hope none of us view each other as opponents. Particularly since I don't know how much money JSI gets from PEPFAR. And I know you didn't mean that. I don't mean it in that term. But I think it is a good sense. It is a good sense. I mean, there are a couple of different things. One is OGAC and one is the PEPFAR. I mean, our office is a piece of PEPFAR. We rely, the implementers of our programs, of the U.S. government programs, meaning our USAID, HHS, Department of Defense, Peace Corps, hundreds, thousands of talented, smart people who care about this more than anything, none of whom are political appointees. And that's how we expect most of the communication to occur, because they're the ones working with you all every day. I think there's also an important communication from our office. We're trying to get better at it. We're spending more time in these types of things on calls. Some of it is we were just so damn busy getting the program going when we started. We just didn't have time, but we're starting to do more and more things, and we're very appreciative of CSIS, Kaiser, and others to offer these venues, and we're very receptive to them. We're picking up the phone a lot more, I think, both ways, and I think we need to do more of that. A lot of this is just trust, and a lot of the misinformation breaks down trust, and when you actually sit in a room with people, you're still going to disagree, but at least you'll trust each other that you don't have a motive that otherwise isn't there. So it's just work, as all communication is, whether it's a relationship in a family or something like this. It's work, and we need to do a better job of it, and I think we all do. And some of that is when you see something, call us. You know, we're available. Call someone at AID, call someone at AJ, whoever your CTO is, call them. If they don't know the answer, they'll call us. Or if there's the communication with our office initially, call us. And let's talk about it. You still might disagree and say, well, I think that's a stupid policy decision, but at least you'll know where it's coming from. And I think Judy, your point is an absolutely critical one. And as more of a bench clinical treatment researcher, I have to say it's tough for me to get my head around some of the behavioral stuff. Behavioral science and behavioral determinations are far more complicated than most things in science. It's completely science, but it's much more difficult. And it's very difficult to say these things led to this. The best we can do now is take all the DHS data, look across it, look at the results, do mathematical models as the Kenyans try to do, and try to figure it out. And as I'm sure opponent wasn't meant, I didn't want to say that people didn't trust or didn't want to hear the data from Uganda. That's not what I meant. It was more that it was the first thing they saw. I mean, there's lots of other data out there. How do you put it all together? Which is why I think these data from Kenya and these regions of the other countries are so important. And unfortunately, the best we can do with behavior most of the time is say, this is what went in, this is what came out, let's hope that actually worked, and do the best we can. And unfortunately, most of what we do in treatment isn't formal science either. We wing it all the time. A lot of this is winging it, but it's winging it based on what we know. And that's why as data evolves, we need to be flexible enough to say, oops, that didn't work. But there is building evidence, and we just need to use it and communicate it.
Thanks. I would actually want to just add one thing to that, and as a segue to wrapping up our session. I think that's that point about the challenge of communicating around behavior change as a science and what how you attribute things is a real challenge. And we actually have on our list of potential topics, which we rely heavily on Judy for, a discussion of she doesn't know this yet, so of a consultation that the WHO held, the Talwar's consultation that looked at behavior change for young people and all of these complexities and how do you really measure it. And I guess one of the lessons or the take-home messages of today is given the complexity of behavior change that we all are acknowledging, it's always going to be a struggle to recognize successes and want to attribute them but not do it in such a codified or rigid way that doesn't allow programs to be flexible and respond to their needs. And I'm not saying that anyone that's what you're saying, but I think there's a tendency to do that, particularly in response to legislative mandates and the need to get reports done and those kinds of things. And I think these dialogues, I hope, will break us away a little bit from that rigidity and allow for some of the flexibility that I think we all know needs to be there in implementation. I'm going to turn this over to Phil in a minute, and Steve might want to make some ultimate concluding remarks. But I really want to thank Mark and the staff at OGAC and let everyone reiterate what Phil said in the beginning. This conversation with the Office of Global AIDS Coordinator about having this meeting started months ago, and it was something everyone was open to, and it really was just an issue of finding a time when we can get everyone together. So we really appreciate that the staff at the Office of Global AIDS Coordinator was willing to do this and that everyone here was willing to be part of the discussion, and we will continue on the committee to find opportunities for these discussions, whether it's more on this topic, on related topics, and on others. And we just hope that everyone here got as much out of it as we did. So thank you. Thanks, Mark.
Yeah. I don't have a lot to add what Jen said. I mean, I think it's been very interesting. Today we heard new data. We heard some clarifications, some of policy, some of which were actually a surprise to me. we heard an acknowledgement that things could be done better on both sides, which I think is true. We heard a request for input, and we heard openness to input and a request for more dialogue. And as Jen said, this CSIS wants this forum to be available for these kind of discussions, not just of U.S. government policy, but of prevention issues in general. Some of the issues are going to be technical, in addition to the political complexities. So again, thanks to all of you for coming, and thanks again to Mark for a great presentation.